This episode is sponsored by Gopher State Tape Library, a 501(c) corporation. Established in 1974, the library has been archiving recovery talks of the many 12-step recovery fellowships across the globe. For almost 50 years, these have been distributed worldwide. The library is the only all-volunteer organization doing this work in existence. There are no paid employees. Thousands of downloads, MP3s, and CDs can be obtained at www.gstl.ecwid.com. The Gathering with Roger B. occurs monthly in Wayzata, Minnesota. Attendees are 12-steppers, those who have been affected by another's addiction, and some who are simply interested in improving their personal level of life satisfaction using a variety of spiritually-based tools. It is also used as a tool for study groups nationwide. The gathering's talks are generally tied to one or more of the 12 steps, but are always guided by spiritual concepts, principles, and ideas common to most faiths. Topics are drawn from a variety of sources, the 12 steps, many of the well-known wisdom texts, science, and other teachers that speak to a spiritual solution to life's challenges. Roger has been in recovery for over 40 years and has spent thousands of hours in service, sharing his experience, strength, and hope. He has created curriculum for treatment centers and leads workshops and retreats throughout the United States and Canada. Roger is a spiritual director and offers insight into spiritually based living skills that are relevant to all people, whether in recovery or not.
Before I get into this, you need to understand, I'm not here to tell you what to do. Not anyone what to do or how to do it. What I'm doing is, for me, what I'm doing is I'm sharing some ideas, I'm sharing some experience, and the hope is that it will stimulate you to think about something maybe that you're struggling with, or the ideas we're talking about will stimulate you to think about something from a little different angle. Or consider it, you know, definitionally kind of important, right? So, having said that, unconditional happiness. How's that sound? Everyone's going, it sounds like... That's like happy, joyous, and free, you mean? No, I mean unconditional happiness. This popped into me out of a book I was reading, and I'm going to give you the backstory on this so you don't, because if you were anything like me when I started that title, my cynicism would have slapped that thing down in 2 seconds. That's just that Disney Channel Hallmark card crap. But here's the idea. In the book, in our big book, in the spiritual experience appendix, it says, most emphatically, we wish to say that anyone capable of facing their problems in the light of our experience can recover. That's a wholesale promise. It doesn't address gender. It doesn't address ethnicity. It doesn't address your social status or how much money you have. It's a blanket promise. And then there are conditions on the promises, as there always are. The condition is, provided you don't close your mind to all spiritual concepts. So that means to get in the game, this game, the 12-step game, I've got to at least be willing to believe in the possibility that a power that is constructive in its nature is available to me somehow, somewhere, at some point in time. I'm willing to believe in the possibility. That's all. With me? Then it says the only thing that can defeat me is my attitude. That's your angle of approach. Intolerance, belligerence, denial, in other words, closed-mindedness, that's the only thing that can defeat us. So how many of you have children or been around infants? Show of hands. Like almost everybody. The Buddhists have an expression, the face you had before you were born, which means they're talking about your soul identity. They're not talking about your personality and your demographics, right? Face you had before you were born. If you watch babies when they're new, they're like puppies. They're happy. All you got to do is feed them and change them. That's the whole demand system right there. And they'll let you know when they need that done. And beyond that, they're just blissful. Have you ever seen babies play with each other? Oh, they're feeding each other. They're swapping spit. They're sharing toys. They're doing all that stuff. There is no mind. The mind comes on at about 9 months. As the brain develops and they get socialized, then you start hearing kids, you put them together for their little play date, and you start hearing, mine, mine, mine. And then you hear crying and screaming, right? So the premise is we come in here perfect. So what happens? The world happens. We get this thing, this identity called self. Have you ever thought about it? Where does that come from? Where does that come from? Who told me what a Sid was? Who told me what a Roger was, what a Miles was, what a Susan was? Who told me that? Not me. I didn't come out of the womb going, well, I think Lutheran sounds good. Keep me away from the Mexicans, and I don't like spicy food. None of that was there, right? I mean, you didn't even know your name until they taught it to you. How'd you learn your name? They repeated it. The same way your dog learns its name. Sorry. But it's the truth, isn't it? I start realizing when they say that sound, Roger, that's not about my sister or my brother or anyone else. It's about me. Every preference I have, I acquired that way. Yeah? Everything. It wasn't my choice. I didn't sit up and make decisions about all this stuff. When they said we're Lutheran, I didn't ask, what are the other options? I didn't even ask what a Lutheran was. And they said, that's what we are. Oh, okay. Right? Think about that. Where does self come from? It's poured into us. It's poured into us. We don't create it. And then we get, well, so mom and dad, maybe some siblings if you got some kids in the family. Then we learn that we got a family, and this is our family, which is different than your family. This is our family. And then we start learning family rules, right? About dinner, about etiquette, about secrets. It's coded, but it's like this. We don't air our dirty laundry in public, which means don't tell anyone what's going on in this house. Got it? Got it. So we get these rules, and we don't know any different. Then you go to school, then you get your neighborhood, then you go to school, then you go to church. You got these institutions that are telling you who and what you are. They're literally telling you what you believe. You get what I'm saying? Now, the gift is, for most of the people in this room, the gift is addiction. And when you have it, it doesn't feel like a gift. It's not a gift until you recover from it. Then it's a gift, and it keeps giving the rest of your life. If you'd be so fortunate to have a life, right? And the gift is, I reach a point where I can go no further, not another inch, on the basis of Roger. On the basis of Roger's thinking, Roger's philosophy, Roger's theology, if he has one, I'm out of ideas. Now, I'm describing me to you. I'm not describing you to you. Because I'm a low-bottom guy, and that means I'm a slow learner, essentially, is what that means. It's no badge of honor. But all the guys that wrote the book, that contributed to the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, were all people that had been incarcerated many times for chronic inebriation. And they were literally on the crap pile for humanity, because the next step for them is lobotomy. So when they stumbled on this mode, if you will, these 12 steps, it was totally accidental and incremental. And it wasn't encoded. It wasn't written down anywhere. So Abby brings it to Bill. Bill brings it to Bob. Those two guys work on a guy named Bill Dodson. They get three guys, and then pretty soon it starts spreading out, right? You got Clarence Snyder up in Cleveland. You got one meeting in Akron. You got half a meeting in New York. And most of those meetings, all those meetings, those two meetings, were deeply entwined with the Oxford group. Okay? So what happened is they had an experience. And they started talking about the experience. Because nobody had ever found a way out of addiction at this point. And they said, I wonder if we could help some people by writing this down. That big book is a 12-step call. because there were only two meetings in the world. Now we got 1,500 meetings a month here, right? But that wasn't the way it started. So they wrote the book with the instructions, the how-to, and what you should be getting as a result of those steps, and they encoded it for us, okay? So I got a map. I got a map. I've got a whole set of procedures, and what that first quote I recited to you says, if you follow the procedures the way the people who created those procedures did, you'll get the results they got. What's the riff in A? Happy, joyous, and free? Doesn't that sound good? It sounds like... What? Malarkey. Malarkey. Thank you so much. Yes, that's the word I was reaching for. Malarkey. Yeah. A whole bunch of malarkey. Deep, deep malarkey. Good. That's good. I'll remember that. Malarkey. Better than Godfrey Daniels. So, what was I saying?
Happy, joyous, and free.
Oh, I hear this and I'm going, happy, joyous, and free means nothing to me. When you're sitting in a meeting and your life is burned down and you got malarkey all over the region, it's not like you're thinking, oh, I can't wait to deal with my malarkey. I can see the sun rising on a new life on the horizon over there. That's not what you're thinking at all. You're thinking, I wonder if I should kill myself. Because I don't see a way out of this. So something weird happens along the way. I hear you, not all of you, but I hear some sharing in meetings that touches me. I mean, touches me in the way when she said that, I've heard it. I didn't hear it in my head. I heard it in my heart. You recognize that truth, right? You resonate to that truth because that truth's in you. So now I start down this road with the steps. And the challenge is to find out who the hell I am. That's the big question, isn't it? Who am I? And then secondarily, why am I here? Because what am I looking for? I'm looking for purpose. So in that part coming up to when everything caved in, I created a lot of small g gods along the way. There's a thing called the false self. And it is a system of thought that's comprised of 5-6 good ideas that will keep you and I forever in misery and struggle. And most of us have been subscribing to those without knowing what they were. I am what I do. Let me show you my business card so you can see what I do, right? When you go to a meeting, a gathering, a convention, some guy meets you, say, hi, I'm Roger. You're Mikey, huh? What do you do? And yeah, I'll say, what's your spiritual condition? Have you found God? I say, what do you do? And he tells me what he does. And that's a big chunk of a lot of our identities. You know, The largest growth in addiction is 60 years old and up. The empty nesters and the retirees. Because they're running into that thing that you and I ran into before we got there, which is who am I and why am I here? Right? And they don't know. And they don't know what to do. Because I did this for 40 years, my job. And that's who I was. And that took up a lot of time. And when I wasn't doing that, I was collecting stuff. That's the second idea. I am what I have. You know? Drive by my house, I'll show you how I'm doing. Right? I got a new car. I added a third stall in the garage. I leave the doors up when I'm home so y'all can see my stuff. Shiny stuff. Nice stuff. It says he's really knocking it out of the park. You see that boat? Yeah, he did. And then Michael bought a boat. He lives two doors down from me. He bought a boat.
Bigger.
four foot bigger, 100 horses more.
Yeah.
So it came to me one morning. I need a new boat, right? And this is the old riff, the Joneses, keeping up with the Joneses, uh-huh. Right? I am what I have. My stuff tells you my status. Here's the problem. If I am my stuff and I am my job, if anything gets between me and that, it's really trouble. It's incendiary. It's for me, it's an existential threat. You know? Because I've bought a lie, which is, if I don't have this title, if I don't have this money, if I don't have this stuff, then with that goes my value. Right? Now, the truth is not your stuff. The truth is not your stuff. Because when something happens and you lose your job or the economy goes to hell, you find out who owns the stuff. It's the bank. It's the bank's boat. It's the bank's motorcycle. It's the bank's house. Right? Anyone read a Richard Rohr? Yeah. Falling Upwards? Mm-hmm. He's got a great metaphor for this. He's saying by definition, the first half of life is egocentric and narcissistic. Because growing up as a little boy, as a girl, I'm trying to figure out who I am. And people are telling me what goes in the container that's Roger. Right? We like higher education. We like football. We like beer. We like anything with alcohol, as it turns out. Right? Hold the ice. No. So all that's programmed into me. I went to school with a guy. And in sixth grade, you know, how old are you in sixth grade? 12? 12? So we're sitting around, everyone's talking about what they want to be when they want to grow up. I have no idea what I want to be when I grow up. But Jay knew. Jay knew. I'm going to be a lawyer. Hi there. Hi. You're late. There's a penalty for that. Here.
I'm sure I'll pay.
Throw 20 in. Now what? I forget what I was doing.
Jay.
Oh, Jay. Jay knew everything he was going to do. I'm going to be a lawyer. All the men in my family are lawyers. And this is the college I'm going to. And this is the law school I'm going to. And then I'm going to work at my dad's law firm. Then I'm going to get a nice, beautiful woman, and I'm going to have some babies, and I'm going to have a family, and eventually, I'm going to be the senior partner at that law firm.
He said that?
Yes!
What?
He knew exactly what he was going to do, and he wasn't kidding, because that had been programmed into him. I ran into him at my 20-year class reunion. It's the only one I've ever gone to. And Jay had it all. And I was still playing, and I walked up, and Jay was now rotund and bald. He was the class president. He was the beautiful guy, the homecoming king. All the girls loved him. Now he's a potato, right? But a wealthy potato. So I go and he looks at my name tag and he goes, "Oh God, we heard you were dead." Well, guess what? I'm here. He said, "What have you been doing?" I said, "I've been running around the country writing music and playing and living out of a Greyhound. What have you been doing?" I said, "I got the law firm. I got the wife and the kids. I got the whole deal. I got the lake home." Great. Good for you. He said, "I'm dying. I'm dying inside. Because I got everything I said I wanted out here. And it didn't fix the incompleteness in here." And we know from our program, the incompleteness in here is the absence of a relationship with your creator, whatever you call that. Fair? And we've been throwing all this stuff in it all our lives, trying to, is this me? No, I just need more money. I was talking to a guy the other night about money. And we're talking about money and how you need to make more money to get out of debt. But the thing that's always escaped me is I never got out of debt. And it's because I had this fiscal policy. It really wasn't a known policy. It wasn't a written policy. But what it was I always spend 15 or 20% more than I make. So you're always in debt. Hello. Hello. Right? And so I would say, I got to make 50,000 bucks this year and get out of debt. And I make the 50,000 and I'd still be in debt. I go, "Well, I must have been wrong." Not 50, it's 60. It's 75. It's 80, and it just keeps going like that. It's a bigger house. It's a condo. It's a townhome. It's a house. It's one bedroom. It's three bedrooms. It's a two-car garage. It's a three-car garage. Then we fill it with people. Right? And I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just trying to make this go away. Am I good enough now? Do you love me now? How about now? You love me if I do this for you? Will you love me if I do that for you? Will you love me if I give you this, if I give you that? Is that good enough? Is that good enough? Will someone please tell me I'm good enough? The problem is, even when they do, you can't wrap your arms around it. Because the thing that's driving this thing is fear and shame. Fear is I'm not safe, and shame is I'm not worthy. So no matter how much success I have, I'm never, ever going to be able to wrap my arms around and say, God, that is sweet. We were playing, we were doing an in-service at the Boston Conservatory of Music with this band I was in. We're doing creative writing classes and improv and stuff, and we were doing these concerts every night for the student body, about 3,500-seat theater. And it was in the 70s, so when you get done with the set, you come out and you put your arms out to you, they take a bow, right? So it was after the first or second encore, and we're bowing, and I'm crying. And everyone's looking at me going, he's so sensitive. And the reason I was crying is the more you loved me, the worse I felt. And when you were standing giving me that ovation, I was thinking, if you knew who I was, you wouldn't be clapping. So even when I got it, I couldn't put my arms around it. So that's what's driving this whole mess. I think happiness is out here. It's not out here for me. It's in here. I think my completeness is in the acquisition of people and status and money and things. It's not. It's in the accessibility to my higher character. It's in the principles that I'm operating from. I never got that. How can you get that while you're doing it? You can't. All I know is it's not working. And I assume it's not working because I need to try harder, not because the idea is a failure. Do you know what I'm saying? Everyone, there's nothing wrong with wanting to be successful, and you decide how you're going to be successful, and then you go about creating a plan to be successful. Goals. God, we hear about goals. You got to have a goal. Got to have a goal. You should probably have several. You should have some short-term goals, some middle-term, and some long-term. Do you remember that financial ad a few years ago? What's your number? All fear-based. What's your number, Mary? Mary goes, I don't know. And the guy goes, oh, my God! What's the message? You're not safe because your number's not there. One, you don't know what the number is. Two, whatever the number is, it's not big enough. So guess what? You're always falling short, and you're going to be terrified because one of your worst fears is going to happen. You're going to get old, you're going to be alone, and you're going to be poor. She's going, shut up. You're going to be alone, you're going to be poor, and you're going to be sick, and no one cares about you. I fell down the stairs, it took them a week to find me. Yeah. Right? All out here. So what I'm doing is I'm entrusting my identity and my happiness, my fulfillment, in things that are finite. Things that don't have, let alone the power. They don't even have this stability or the staying power to produce it. And I got this other thing about being unworthy. So no matter what I get, it will be nice for a while. For me, it was like a 30 to 90 day period it felt really great achieving that thing that I've been trying to achieve. And it was a nice feel and a glow for about 30 to 90 days. And then the ache came back. You know the ache I'm talking about? Like the Chinese food ache. It's like you're out, you eat Chinese, and you're just, I can't even have the bite. I can't even have the bite. Then we're driving around about an hour later. And I go, God, I'm hungry. Are you? You know, it's that thing. Except with stuff. Out here. You know, I like it that you like me. There's nothing wrong with that. But I can't pin my identity and my self-worth on whether you like me or not. The third one is, I am what you think of me, which is what we're talking about. The fourth one is, I'm not connected to you, which is really convenient. Because if you're between me and a goal, or if you appear to be messing with something that I've acquired and established, you are going to be in trouble. because you're going to get out of the way one way or another. I'll either move you out of the way, or I'll manipulate you out of the way, but you cannot stand between me and my stuff. Cannot. And once I get scared enough, every value I have, those values that allow me to grow and strive, my social security and sex instinct, those things become inflamed, and it's like World War III. Because for me, it's a matter of life and death. Got a new guy in the office. I'm the number one salesperson. New guy in the office, really hungry. I don't like this. He's really eager. And I'm established. So I meet Peter in the coffee room one day, and I'm going, you know that new guy? Wow, I don't know. He's doing some weird stuff. I don't want to gossip. I'm just saying. I'm just checking. Have you noticed any weird stuff from him? As a matter of fact, I have, you know. And so we start this character assassination. Very subtle, right? Just a little undermining. Nothing big. So, one of the first things I got to realize is what I've been trying to do to make it okay, to make me okay, to make me whole, to make me safe, to make allow me to be happy, and it's at a modicum of peace, it's all been wrong. It's not that I'm a bad boy. It's not that God is punishing me. I have hooked my life energy up to some ideas that are bankrupt. They can't support me. And we come by it honestly, don't we? We learn in our families. We learn in our culture. We learn in our society. The part of the country you grew up in, you learn that, right? Then you get this thing called the work ethic. Man, oh, I come from Germans. They know how to work. And work is, you know, exhaustion is a blue ribbon. I worked 100 hours this week. Oh, man, you're killing it. Yeah, it's killing me. But I don't know what else to do. That's how I was raised. You work hard. Oh, and you play hard. That's the reward for working hard. And then you play more than you work eventually. And then stuff starts going away. And then you realize, what's a nice guy like me doing in a squad car? How did this happen, right? I forget what I was going to say.
Squad car.
What?
What are you doing sitting in the squad
car?
Nice guy like me.
I don't know what I'm doing there. I don't know how that happened. I'm sure it's a mistake. Oh, I was going to say this way of being in the world is mistaken. It's not that I'm bad. Shame wants to tell me I'm being punished. It's mistaken. I got some ideas, and I don't think they're necessarily bad ideas, but what I did with the ideas ended up being really hurtful and detrimental to me. And then when you add the addiction on top of that, what does our book say? What did Bill say? When Ebby was visiting him, Bill's drunk. He's drinking all day. And he has this, And he says, Ebby, what you're explaining to me makes really good sense. It's pretty simple, but it's not easy. And the aha is, it means the destruction of my selfish self-centeredness. It means I can't drink anymore. And that's the key. I am so self-absorbed. Everything is about me. Everything. And so I'm in a constant state of threat. Little threat, big threat. Little threat, big threat. Constantly in a defensive posture. You know, when you walk in and you're really concerned about what people think about you, I am what you think of me. I'm walking in the room, I'm looking around, we got 40 people. I need to win 40 people over. And this was when I was in my rock and roll days. I come in after party, right? And these are the money people and all this. And I would always come late because I like to make my entrance. And I'd stand in the doorway because I like backlighting. You know? And I'd stand in the doorway and wait till I'm scoping the room to see who's in charge. Because that's the first person I got to co-op. That's the person I got to win over and say, oh, look at Roger's here. Oh, the singer's here. Blah, blah, blah. Right? So I figure out who that is, and I go up, and I get next to Sid, and she doesn't announce me. And I'm thinking, bitch, don't you know who I am? No, no, I'm just going, hey, this isn't working out. My plan is not working out. So now I'm getting more and more uptight. I don't know I'm uptight. I don't know this is the deal. And so she hasn't announced me to the room, so you don't know I'm here. And I'm feeling insecure, but I don't see it as insecurity. I see it as disrespect. And so I got to blow this room up. You understand? And I'm going to blow it up one of two ways. I will start with humor, because that's it's less violent. I will start with humor. And if it's not working, I'll just get more and more outrageous with the humor. If that doesn't work, I'll just go to the dark side. Because what I want is I want every pair of eyes in that room on me. I don't care if you hate me or love me, but I need those eyeballs on me because that's when I feel like I'm in control, false perception, and then I feel safe. Wouldn't it be nice to not have to do that? There's a Longfellow prayer. Lord, help me be free of the good opinion of others. You know, you can't be free of the good opinion of others until you know who you are. And you can't know who you are until you know what the principles are that you're basing your actions off of. And once I know that, I don't care what you think of me. Now, I'm not trying to be offensive. I'm not trying to hurt anyone. But I'm just saying, you know, I know I'm not for everybody. I do a lot of this kind of stuff. I know that there's people in here going, isn't it time to be done? You know? Can't we go yet? You know, you can go anytime you want. And there's other people that are going, oh, I like this. And there's other people going, I have no idea what this guy's saying, which is not my problem. Not my deal. Right? But boy, it took a long time to get free of that. It took a long time to get free of that. And I didn't understand what the mechanism was. What did we say? 10, 11, 12. I'm building a new life. I'm not rebuilding the old life because that didn't work. I'm building a new life on the principles that I pulled out of these steps and this quote unquote spiritual approach to living. I'm building a new life. That takes practice, a lot of practice. In the beginning, it's like, you know, how long do I have to go to these meetings? You know, when do we graduate around here? Some of you people look like you've been here a long time, right? And then it's later on, I get to go to these meetings, right? What do you mean I got to do these steps the rest of my life? That sounds like a jail sentence. But when you recover, it's I get to do this. And it's a blessing, isn't it? It's a blessing. I am so blessed. Because we have a way out of this mess, this acute selfish self-centeredness, this living in a constant state of dis-ease, pain, depression, anxiety, all the different forms of fear, right? We can get out from under that. That's a big deal. So back to the baby. The thing that stands between me and unconditional happiness is me. It's all these things we've been talking about. It's all my ideas. It's all my attitudes. It's the principles that I'm operating on. You can't be happy and free when you're a slave to what people are thinking. And when you're a slave to the possessions you have and how much money you have and your attitudes about all those things, you can't be free, right? I'm the block to my happiness. They said it in the book, in the third step. After, or maybe it was in the fourth step. Yeah, it was the fourth step, reflection. After we look at those first three columns in the resentments, who hurt you, what did they do, and how did it affect you, we get it down and look at it, and they ask us to reflect. And the first reflection is, do you see how much your past is dominating you? Well, now that you point it out, I'm starting to see it. I did not see it before. And then they say, after all, our problems were of our own making. That's the story. That's the narrative I've created since I was a little boy. Not since I started drinking. Since I was a little boy, since you were a little girl, we were building that story. You meet people and they go, tell me about you. And what do? We whip out the woundology, right? My parents, like active alcoholism. My mom's emotionally unavailable. My dad's asshole. It totally stunted my emotional growth. No love. And what love there was all conditional. And it just goes on and on. It's our woundology. It's how it's my story about me, how I've been screwed, how I've been banged up, how I've been mistreated, how I've got the short end of the stick. Oh, well, right? To varying degrees, but isn't it the truth? I go, this is why I'm the way I'm in. And it was never, this is the way I am because I'm screwed up. It was, this is the way I am because all of you are screwed up. No one loved me enough. No one loved me right. And then I go try and find that. Approval, acceptance, love, right? So we begin to understand our addiction as a disconnection from that goodness, from that face we had before we were born. There's nothing wrong with you. You're not missing anything. What's happened is I am what I do. I am what I have. I am how much money I make. I am what you think of me. I'm not connected to you, and I'm not connected to God. Has gotten in the way. It's gotten between me and that goodness, like an eclipse. And you know this from your experience, those of you that are doing it. As you do those steps, especially 4 through 9, things start to change, don't they? I get a little clarity. I get a little different understanding. And my life seems to be changing. I think it's a miracle because I don't know what I'm doing. It's not a miracle. It's a promise of that process. And we were talking about this before the meeting. Everything you don't put through that remains a problem. And not a problem like it was 5 years ago. It grows. It's like a cancer. Because it's, I've got these secret things over here, my sacred cows, if you will, my special things that I'm never telling anyone about, and I'm never going to ever put through these steps because then I'll lose them. They're my treasures. And it turns out those were the very most harmful things that I had in the toolbox. And I'm lucky I've lived through it. Because it brought me to my knees at 5 and 10 years. And I don't mean figuratively, I mean literally. I didn't do this. I didn't change because I was virtuous. Thank you for your confirmation, Flo. I changed because I was desperate. I changed because I couldn't run this idea one more inch, whatever the idea was. I thought the drinking and the drugs were the problem, as did most of everybody in the room that has that problem. But now you're not doing it. What's the problem now? The problem is between my ears. It's always been between my ears. Anything that stands between, well, you saw it in We Agnostics. The main object of the book is to enable you, the reader, to find the power, and the power will solve your problem. And it's singular. I only got one problem. And it's whatever the idea is that's dominant that I'm courting right now. And if the idea is I want to move closer to G-O-D, I want to be move closer to patience or kindness or tolerance, I'll get one set of consequences. And if the idea is of the darker order, I need to get some of me for me. I need some more money. I need some more sex. I need some more applause. I need some more something, right? Then I'm going to get those results. It's not magic. It's process. It's totally based on the principles that you serve will produce the consequences. So the consequences, the quality of the things in your life are a direct reflection of your spiritual condition, right? It takes some time. It takes some time to get this, right? Work with this guy and like a year sober, doing really well. Then he's 15 months sober. Then he's a half, year and a half sober, and he's, oh, God, this and God, this. Then all of a sudden the IRS wants to talk to him. And he goes, why is this happening to me? I've been really good. I've been really doing my recovery. Why is this happening to me? It's happening to you because of what you did before you recovered. I was whining in meetings about all the money I owed people. I said, everyone wants, by the time I get to pay all these guys, I got nothing left. They've all taken my money. They're all getting ready to take my money. And this old guy looks at me and says, no, they want their money. They just want their money. Really? I never thought of it that way. Good point, and I don't ever want to see you again. They want their money. Oh, that's right. God, right? So that's the theory. I stand between me and my joy or my happiness are my peace. You know, I was talking to Susan before the meeting or over the last couple of days because we have many disagreements about this stuff. I don't like happy, joyous, and free. It doesn't mean anything to me. If it means something to you, that's great. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it. It's wrong with me. Happy, joyous, and free doesn't work for me. But when you say, are you happy, joyous, and free? I will say, I have purpose, direction, satisfaction, contentment, and most of all, peace. Peace. Not fighting you. Not fighting your ideas. I'm not fighting anything. Maybe growing old a little bit. Just kidding. No. You know what I'm saying? And that's the get. That's the thing. None of that stuff that I just recited to you was on the list when I started in 1978. It wasn't on the list in 1985. Probably wasn't even on the list in 1995. Do you know what I'm saying? Because these things didn't seem to be substantive enough to sustain a life. So I had to deprogram myself. That's what you're doing. I'm deprogramming myself with the steps. I'm getting oriented along different lines because the lines I've been oriented on have not served me. And so when we look at this, the flaws and the mistakes and the problems we get into, it's not from the drinking. It was from all the years preceding the drinking that was demanding for relief. And then we found the relief in the substance. And for a while that worked. It worked beautifully. And then the substance was not offering the same relief and a couple of consequences were kicking up around it. But in the early days, the consequences were well worth the reward. Yeah? And the other problem for me was alcohol was always a solution to me. So the idea that it was a problem was very foreign. Cops are a problem. Alcohol's not a problem, right? Because it was always a solution. And I can't love it because now it owns me and I don't know it owns me because it doesn't tell me, I own you. It says, I'm your best friend. In fact, I love you. And no matter what happens, I've got your back. You stick with me. You stick with me. Then you realize I'm in trouble. And you go to hit the brakes, there are no brakes. That's when I start realizing something's changed, right? Most of us don't come to that quickly. Most of the people I know come to it slowly. I mean, you might have come to it quickly. So, food for thought.
New episodes of The Gathering are published twice a month and can be found on Spotify and other major podcast apps. You can follow The Gathering on Spotify and others to receive monthly notifications of new episodes.